ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to have you here. Thank you very much for coming. We're going to be bringing in some more seats. We were very pleasantly surprised. We've had a rush of additional people coming this afternoon, I think for very good reason, and I'm delighted to have all of you here. Welcome. This is a combined session of our Military Strategy Forum and a series that we've had this year called Smart Power, which is an effort to try to say that how does America get a composite strength in both its diplomacy, its hard military power, its foreign assistance, etc. The focus here is to look at all of those tools, and I had an opportunity to see a presentation that Admiral Stavridis gave about 3 months ago, and I said this is quintessentially the best demonstration of smart power, and I think you're going to be dazzled by what you see. First, let me just say a word of welcome. No. What did I say? Dazzled.
Nothing like a setup.
Nothing like a setup. Well, and let me first say welcome, Secretary Rumsfeld. Delighted to have you here. Now I know what it takes to get you to one of my events. It's having a former military assistant is what it takes. And Jim, I want you to please do not. You've had to listen to him talk a long time, so please do not take revenge today. I mean, don't. This is not your chance to get even.
Sure.
Welcome, Secretary. We're delighted to have you here, and we're delighted to have all of you here. I'm going to let Dr. Steve Flanagan do the formal introduction, but I did want to say I had an opportunity to go up to the Naval War College back in October for one of those kind of training camps for 3 stars. You know, it was one of those things that we do. And he didn't know I was going to be there. I was kind of hiding in the back. And it was a spectacular demonstration of what the modern combatant commander has to do and should be doing. It really was remarkable. And I said to myself, this is something we don't hear in Washington. This is something we need to hear in Washington. So Jim kindly agreed to come down here to do that share with us the insights on what he's doing in his AOR. And it's one of those neglected AORs in Washington. You know, I mean, I hate to say it. It's we have a polite term called, an AOR of economy, which means we don't give him anything. And so it means he's got to figure it out with what little we do give him to run this theater. And I think you're going to be really quite impressed. So I'm delighted that you're here, Jim. Thank you for that. And Steve, let me turn it over to you for the real introductions. Welcome, everybody. Glad you're here.
Thank you. As Dr. Hamry said, this is a combined, in military terms, it's a combined operation between the Smart Power project here at CSIS and the International Security Program, which I represent, and we're delighted to have a number of our other practitioners here of Smart Power, who this commission that issued a report earlier this year, co-chaired by former Deputy Secretary of State Rich Armitage and Professor Joe Nye at the Kennedy School at Harvard, talking about this whole question of how can we better integrate and rebalance the way in which we use American military power and all the other instruments of American power in advancing our influence and improving our image around the world. And that's why when we had heard about Admiral Stavridis, first we knew very well about his work in Southcom, but when we heard his presentation earlier this year and thought that this was a good opportunity not only to promote some of the thinking in the Smart Power Commission, but also to enhance this dialogue that we have ongoing here at CSIS with the military and military strategy community under this other co-sponsor rubric, which is our Military Strategy Forum. And many of you who are longtime participants in that know what that involves. We oftentimes invite combatant commanders, other senior military leaders to come here for dialogue with the wider community of defense thinkers and strategists here in Washington. And we are greatly appreciative of the sponsorship that Rolls-Royce North America provides for that forum, which has been an important and open forum. And so just to go over a little bit before I introduce Admiral Stavridis, the ground rules, as you know, normally in our military strategy forum, to encourage candor is completely off the record on background, non-attribution. But this evening, Admiral Stavridis will make his opening remarks, will be on the record. And then we'll revert to, just for those of you in the working media who are here, we'll revert to a background non-attribution off-the-record rules for the Q&A session. So just to clarify, and then just that a necessary reminder, since we are taping this for a CSIS TV at least, and probably maybe some other use onward in our website, if it asks you, just turn off or at least silence your cellular devices so we don't have any embarrassments to you or us during the proceedings. You have his full biography, and I think he would probably get angry if I went on too long here in the introduction, especially after Dr. Hamray's comments about being dazzled. But indeed, Admiral Stavridis, who took command at Southcom in October of 2006, has been making sure that sometimes neglected part of our overall global area of interest is getting more attention and getting some very creative and interesting approaches in the development of his theater security cooperation efforts, which we're going to hear from about shortly. But in addition to be, as Dr. Hamray noted, a great practitioner of smart power, he is his hard power credentials are impeccable. Of course, many of you may know that he served as, and you'll see in the bio there, that he commanded the Enterprise Strike Group in 2002-2004 and in the process of supporting Operation Enduring Freedom or Operation Iraqi Freedom. He has a number of other command assignments as a surface warfare officer and a number of other assignments in leadership and in the development of naval strategy, Deep Blue and other, and of course, as we heard, to the Secretary of Defense. In addition to that, he, as many of you may know, he also holds a PhD from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. So he has a man of many, many talents and great insight, and we're delighted to welcome here this evening to this joint forum of the Military Strategy and Smart Power Lecture Series. So, General, welcome.
Steve, thank you so much. Thank you very much. Well, it's a delight to be here. Dr. Hamray initially said, now we know what it takes to get Secretary Rumsfeld out. I have long known what it takes to get him out, and that's free drinks. And in the back right there. Mr. Secretary, you honor me greatly with your presence, and I thank you for your friendship, and I thank you for all you've done for this country. I see so many other friends and shipmates from different times in my life here, too numerous to name, but I thank you all for coming tonight, and what I'd like to do is plunge right into this. John Hamray told me to speak for about 2.5 hours. Is that everybody's schedule okay? Yeah. I'll try and kind of clip through this. I'd like to use some images. Like everyone else, I hate PowerPoint. I hate formal briefings. But I do think in this world that is evolving, it is helpful at times to put an image up. So I'll just kind of put a few images up there and talk to them. And then I think, as always, the interesting part will be some questions and answers. Let me start with this image over here. It's obviously the Western Hemisphere. It's the Americas. And let me start by saying, as I travel around and I give talks like this, people often say to me, Admiral, you know, what you're doing is so important because, you know, that's America's backyard. Let me tell you, I hate that expression. It's really, frankly, wrong in every dimension. It is not America's backyard. It is not our front porch. It is a home, and this is my thesis for you tonight. It is a home that we share together. And frankly, even the expression America's backyard kind of doesn't quite work, because if you stop and think about it, all of the billion plus people who live in our home with us, we're all Americans. A Jamaican is an American. A Colombian is an American. A Canadian is an American. So that expression kind of doesn't work on a lot of different levels. And so my thesis is the best thing we can do for ourselves in the United States, for our security, for our prosperity, is to think of that image as a home that we share together. And it is a very diverse home. In other words, another thing I often hear is, well, you know, Jim, it must be great to be Southcom because, you know, all the countries are kind of the same. Can there be two more different countries in the world than Brazil, an emerging megapower of almost 200 million people where they speak Portuguese, two more different countries than Brazil and Belize, a tiny African-centric population where the official language is English. Can there be two more different countries than Chile, an industrialized first world country of 15 million people, kind of the Singapore, the Ireland of this hemisphere, verging into real globalization, the country in the world with the most free trade agreements with other nations of any country in the world? Can there be two more different countries than Chile and Haiti, the poorest country in the region, the majority, the vast majority of the population living on less than $2 a day, where they speak French? Of those four countries, only one spoke Spanish. That's Chile. So the languages are similar, but they're different, and the countries are enormously different. And so my opening thesis for you as we think together about the Americas is that it's our home, and here in the United States, we should understand that there is enormous diversity in this hemisphere, but there are many things that link us together. And that's what I'd like to spend the first part of my few moments talking to you about, are these linkages. To do that, I would say, next slide please, that one needs to understand the history and the culture of the region. That's true, obviously, anywhere in the world. But here, the history, the culture, the languages are all extraordinarily approachable for us. We can do this, and we can understand who the figure on the left is. It's Francisco Pizarro, the worst of the conquistadors. That's a high bar to get over, but the most brutal of all the conquistadors. He came and famously conquered the Incan Empire, founded Lima. In the upper right is a figure that most of you don't know. It's Pedro Carvalho. He's a Portuguese sea captain who discovers what is today Brazil. And there's something kind of instructive in that, isn't there? That we all kind of know who Pizarro is, and almost everybody here learned in Mrs. Dodge's fifth grade history class who Pizarro was, but we don't know who found the mega power of this region. We don't know enough about Brazil, and that's an example of how we need to understand more about culture and more about history. And in the lower right is the cathedral in Santiago, Chile. I put it there, first of all, because it's a magnificent building. Secondly, because it informs us as to the immense importance of the Catholic religion in this part of the world. And thirdly, because that cathedral was built in the 1600s, when in our, the United States part of the world, almost no structure went over two stories. That cathedral was completed. So we need to understand more, I would argue, about this home we share together, its history, its culture, and its language. Next slide. That's an arresting image. It is something we all must understand about this part of the Americas to the south of us, and it is the face of poverty. It's a photograph that I keep on the wall in my office because 40% of the people in this region to the south of us, 40% live on less than $2 a day. That's the cost of a latte at Starbucks, $2 a day. 20% of those people live on less than $1 a day. This is a Haitian man. He is 37 years old. That's the face of poverty. You need to understand the degree to which poverty is woven through the society to the south of us. Next slide. This, of course, almost all of us in the United States would say, that's Havana, right? It's a Chevy. It's Cuba. And I put it, that's the other photo that's on the wall. And you see in the background there a grandmother and abuela head down in despair. I keep that picture in my office not to remind me about Cuba per se, but to remind me that in many ways this is a region that has not emerged into the globalized world that the rest of us enjoy. And there are a lot of reasons for that we could talk about tonight. But it is important for us here in North America, in the United States, understand the extent to which poverty is a big part of the society and the fact that they have not as yet emerged into the global economy. Now, I am more encouraged over the last 2 or 3 years than over the 25 years since I began studying this region, doing my graduate work at the Fletcher School, but in so many ways that Chevrolet is still indicative of much of this region. Next slide. Here you see the third image that I think one needs to bear in mind. And to me, the photograph is a child, obviously, standing in a line of people to receive medical care from a U.S. Navy hospital ship, the Comfort, which I will talk about in more depth as we go along. But that is the face, to me, that is the potential of the region, the promise of the region. I mean, promise is a very interesting word in English. It has two very distinct meanings. A promise is an agreement that we make. I promise I'll quit talking soon, which I'm sure makes you happy. Un compromiso in Espanol. That's one kind of promise. But there's another kind of promise, right? I mean, it's the promise as in the potential. Roger Pardo Maurer has great promise. He's an individual of great promise. He has great potential. This part of the world to the south of us has enormous promise in that sense. I mean, if you will, to demonstrate that, think about the year 1500. Go back in your mind to the year 1500. If you drew a line across the Americas in the northern part of Mexico, above that line and below that line, in the year 1500, things are kind of the same. It's the same topography, the same geography, the same climatology, the same agrarian potential, the same natural resources. Indigenous populations, more developed, obviously, in the south, frankly. Conquistadors knocking at the doors of both sides of that line. 1500, it's all kind of the same. Now, come forward 5 centuries to the year 2000. You would think, logically, it would have come out roughly the same. Obviously, it did not. To the north of that line across northern Mexico is the richest part of the world. To the south, the poorest. So the potential is there. And so a great deal of study and thought has been put into why that is, why development has lagged in the south. And that's really not our topic tonight. But my point in the conversation we're having tonight is that it's a region of extraordinary promise, if we can unlock it. And there are things we can do here in the United States, broadly as a country, some specifically in the Department of Defense, that are useful in unlocking the promise. Next slide, please. Let me talk a little about linkages and what connects us. What is the connective tissue between the United States of America and this region? Dark green is a country whose largest trading partner is the United States, and lighter green is second largest. So you see instantly the web of economic linkage that binds us here in our home in the Americas. 40% of the trade of the United States goes north and south. That's more than goes east or more than goes west. Economically, we are embedded in the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which some folks in this room work very hard on. We have individual free trade agreements with other countries in the region. We have several more important ones, notably Colombia's and Panama's, that are up in front of the Congress. So there's an enormous economic linkage. The geography speaks for itself. Politically, this is a region where today virtually every nation in the region is a democracy. Now, we in the United States don't always agree with every one of our democratic neighbors, but every country save one, Cuba, today is a democracy. So there are political connections here that are very, very strong, political, economic, militarily. Our military works very closely, very effectively with the militaries of virtually every country in this region, including some with whom we have political disagreements. We work very well with the Nicaraguan military, we work very well with the Bolivian military, we work very well with the Ecuadorian military, for example. Don't always agree politically, but our military linkages are quite close and quite strong. So an enormous basket of geographic, economic, and political linkages bind us together. But the next picture is the one that I think the most profound in terms of these linkages for the United States. This is a very important map. Blue represents a state where the population is more than 10% Latino. The darker the blue, like California, New Mexico, Texas, the higher the percentage of the Latino population. You see a lot of blue where you'd sort of expect it in the Southwest, but look at New England, the Middle Atlantic, the Upper Midwest, 15% of our population today in the United States is of Latino descent. Today, the United States of America is the second largest Spanish-speaking country in the world, after only Mexico. More people speak Spanish, more people are of Latino descent, let alone speak Spanish, in the United States of America today, more than in Colombia, than in Spain, than in Argentina, any other country saving only Mexico. That number is growing rapidly. By the middle of this century, best demographic estimate is that one in four of the people in the United States of America will be of Latino descent, and one in three will speak Spanish as a first or second language. So we have an enormous demographic linkage to this part of the world. Now let me tell you what these little dots are on the map. A black dot right up here, all these black dots, including the yellow ones with black around them, those were the 10 largest cities in the United States of America 100 years ago, the 10 largest cities. Today, in the United States, the 10 largest cities are the yellow dots. Three still left up there. Seven of the 10 largest cities in the United States, that's San Francisco, of course, San Jose, are arrayed in states on our southern border. It's Dallas, it's Houston, San Antonio, the eighth largest city in the United States of America, Phoenix, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Jose. Those last three, San Diego, Los Angeles, and San Jose, San Francisco, I give them the Spanish pronunciation because there's another name for all those cities. It's the Camino Real, the King's Highway, the King of Spain. So there's an enormous demographic movement in this direction. There is a growing Latino population in the United States. And across the bottom here, these are the most common surnames, the most common last names in the United States today. And the list starts out with the names we would all expect: Smith, Johnson, Williams, Brown. And in the top 15, you find Garcia, Rodriguez, Martinez, and Hernandez. Four of the top 15 surnames in the United States. So my point is there is a growing demographic linkage that will complement the economic, the political, and the military ones that we sort of commonly associate. So it's a region that we should think of as a home, in my opinion. We have profound linkages in it. That's all kind of good news. Let me tell you about the bad news. Let me tell you about the challenges in this region. And I would put this at the top of the list. This is drugs. It is narcotics. Drugs are the fuel in the car of misery in this part of the world. And I would argue that drugs have a significant effect not only in the United States. And this is cocaine being unloaded from a plane that crash-landed in Haiti on a drug flight from Venezuela. The cocaine came out of Colombia. Cocaine today in the United States kills somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000 U.S. citizens every year. Every year. That's overdoses, that's police activity involving cocaine busts, that's innocent bystander shot, that's gang warfare over turf and cocaine. That's a big number, 7,000 to 10,000 a year. That's a significant impact in the United States. Additionally, and for our purposes here tonight, most significantly, it is destabilizing fragile democracies throughout the region, notably in Central America. It has had massive impact in the Andean Ridge, where the cocaine is produced. It is impacting the Caribbean Basin, and we are starting to see significant impacts in Brazil. So at the top of the list of challenges we face in the region, I would start with narcotics. Next slide. These are the characters that move it. These are the gangs, the maras, pandillas, there's different names for them. A lot of the gang culture is indigenous to the area. A lot of it came out of the United States when citizens of these countries, particularly in Central America, came to the United States, were busted, put in our prisons, deported. This connection between gangs and violence and drugs is an enormously destabilizing factor in Mexico, Central America, contributes to the illegal migration into the United States, and I would say is a significant problem related to the drugs in the region. Next slide. Unfortunately, in the region, there is also significant problems with mass migration. This has been a recurring problem for the United States. This is a big boatload of Haitians. You can go back in the recent past to 1980, when during the Mariel boat lift, 125,000 Cubans were exported by Fidel Castro to our shores. It was followed by a second fairly large Cuban migration, about 40,000 in 1994. About throughout that period, about 200,000 Haitians have come. Last year, 15,000 Cubans, Haitians, and citizens of the Dominican Republic came on boats like that to the United States. It's a human tragedy. It is also destabilizing in our southern states, in Florida and other places. We also need to be very concerned about Cuba as events unfold there, that we don't see a catastrophic mass migration out of Cuba. So that's another challenge in the region that we bear in mind closely at Southcom. Next slide, please. This is a massive hurricane. You can probably guess what it is. It's about to hit New Orleans. It's Katrina. There are, every year, throughout this part of the region, many hurricanes. They are extremely destructive. They are only part of the natural disasters that afflict the region, which range from volcanoes to earthquakes to flooding to landslides. That's kind of the face of natural disaster. But it's another challenge that overlays particularly fragile democracies in the Caribbean and in Central America. Next slide. This gentleman, very senior kind of gentleman, he's almost 80. He'll turn 80 years old this year. And I know I saw the Colombian attaché here, I think. There he is, sir. You know who this gentleman is. Tiro Fijo, Sure Shot, Marulandia. He is the head of the FARC, the insurgent group in Colombia. This is the face of another significant challenge in the region, which is insurgent groups. Colombia has been in an absolute battle for many years. The FARC was founded in the 1960s. They probably hit their peak in the 1980s. The good news is that the FARC and Colombia are very literally back from the brink. And there's an extraordinarily well-done study produced by CSIS. Peter DeShazo, where are you? Peter's here. There he is, sir. Lead writer on a study about Colombia. The insurgents in the jungle, if you will, trying to unseat governments, occurred not only in Colombia and Peru, the Sendero Luminoso, Tupac Amaru. There are a number of these movements. The good news is they are weaker now than they were 10 years ago. There's enormous progress. I would argue particularly in Colombia, their numbers have been reduced. Their leadership is aging. And over time, I think this is a challenge that will be overcome. But it is very much part of the landscape in this region today. So we've looked at a number of very specific, factual kinds of challenges the United States faces in the region. Let's talk a little about the political challenge we face. This is a very interesting photograph. I mean, this is really one that's in the category of a picture tells 1,000 stories. Most of you know who these folks are. This is Hugo Chavez over here on the left. This is Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia. And this is Rafael Correa, the president of Ecuador. They are leaning together. They're close. You can sense their collective thoughts at work. They are at the inauguration of the president of Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega. This gentleman, leaning to the right here, is a well-known figure and is an extraordinary man. His name is President Uribe. He's the president of Colombia, and he is leaning pretty far to the right. I make no political prognostications. But I think it's a good picture to sort of indicate that today in Latin America is a competitive environment for us politically. In other words, for years we've been able to kind of take it for granted that our friends, our neighbors, our partners to the south were kind of with us. And we had some disagreements. But I would argue at this moment in time, there is some drift away from the United States. And that's unfortunate. Some say we are in a battle of ideas. I don't think that's quite the right image in this part of the world. I think we are in a battle for ideas against Islamic fascism in the Middle East, for example. In this part of the world, which is so appropriate to this part of the world, we're in a marketplace. We are in a marketplace of ideas. And our ideas in the United States are capitalism, free markets, free trade agreements, human rights, democracy, and liberty. Two different, both very important things, but different. Those are our ideas. We're in the marketplace competing. There are other ideas in the marketplace with us. From Venezuela, there is the idea of Bolivarian socialism, and it's a very different concept than we espouse here. And my thesis is we, the United States, need to be a good competitor in this marketplace. We need to show why our ideas are better, are sensible, will produce good results, and I think we can do that. I think we have the capability to do that, and I would argue in a moment, I will, that there's a role for all of us in the country, there's a role for the U.S. government, and there's some specific things the Department of Defense can do to be contributory to the total U.S. government effort in this competitive marketplace, which I would argue is a very important one for us in the United States. Next slide. There are also outside influencers. Okay? There are other competitors in this marketplace. This gentleman, of course, is Ahmadinejad, president of Iran, a state sponsor of terrorism. He is a very dangerous man, and he is in this area of the world. Iran has opened 10 embassies. President Ahmadinejad says he wants to have an embassy in every country in this region. Venezuela just inaugurated nonstop flights from Caracas to Tehran. They're not nonstop. They stop in Damascus, Syria. And so my view is we have to be very aware of outside influencers who are trying to come into this part of the world. The Monroe Doctrine passed away a long time ago in a real context. We're in a competitive marketplace. We need to compete. I think our ideas stand up. But there is obviously close connection between President Ahmadinejad and some of the actors in this region. And we need to be aware of that because, and let me show you this image, this is what I worry about the most for this region. If you think of narco-terrorism, which is what the FARC practices as one stream of a flamethrower, it's bad. And it has real effects here in the United States, and it has real effects in Colombia. Narco-terrorism. It's bad, but it's not hooked up yet with Islamic terrorism. Think of the other stream of that fire, Islamic radical terrorism. What I worry about in this region with outside actors coming into it is the potential for those streams to cross, if you will, for the fuel of narco-terrorism to become engaged in Islamic radicalism here in the Americas, in our home. That is a bad scenario for the United States. So when I talk here in a few minutes about what should we do about all this, what we need to put at the top of the list is understanding the potential for terrorism in this region. Today there are financing, there are recruiting efforts, there is proselytizing in this region. I do not believe there is an active operational terrorist cell in the region, but I fear greatly that the connectivity between narco-terrorism and Islamic radical terrorism could be disastrous in this region. So it is a significant area of concern as we look at this entire part of the world, again, our home. Next slide. So what you should be saying is, well, Admiral, that's a good list of problem sets. So what should we do about it? Well, at this point, I'd like to kind of drill down, if you will, into what my lane is, what a combatant commander should be doing and thinking about in this part of the world. And I want to start with this slide, which is an illustration of something I say occasionally, which is in this part of the world, we're not launching Tomahawk missiles. We're launching ideas. We're launching ideas. Again, it's a competitive marketplace of ideas. And the odds of having active combat in this part of the world are low. They're not impossible, but they're low. And so here, strategic communications is incredibly important. And that's what this slide is. It's the contrail of a Tomahawk missile threaded into the word ideas. And my belief is that we, all of us in the government, and we are trying to do this hard down at Southcom, we need to build muscular shops that do strategic communications, that understand what ideas work in a region, what ideas don't work, how we connect with the rest of the interagency, how we connect with international efforts, and how we can be contributory in that marketplace of ideas to showing that our ideas in the United States are the appropriate ones. And I think there's a role to play for all of us in the room who are interested in this area. And again, functionally speaking, this runs the gamut from things like deploying a hospital ship to Comfort, to sending a baseball team down there to play baseball teams all around the region, to traditional military exercises and exchanges. These are all forms of strategic communication that can be undertaken and I think are very effective, again, in this marketplace of ideas. Next slide. To be effective in communicating anything, you have to understand the culture, the language. So this is a very busy-looking slide, but if I could just break it down for you, in the upper left are films, movies. There's a lot to be learned by looking at what movies are made and how those inform a culture. We, once a month, will show a foreign film down at Southcom to our 1,500 people or so to help them understand the drug culture, the life in the favelas. There are wonderful books to be read. There's not only history, there's not only biography, there's not only memoir, there's also novels. Can you really understand the culture of this region if you have not read the novels of Gabriel Garcia Marquez? I don't think so. Have you read Isabel Allende? Have you read Mario Vargas Llosa? So there's film, there's reading. This is a Rosetta Stone, there's language. Today at Southcom, 40% of us speak a second language. In the Department of Defense as a whole, about 8% speak a second language. We work very hard on our language capability, and we're lucky because the languages are easy in our region. And a reasonably intelligent person can become functional in Spanish, French, or Portuguese in a year or two of study. And so we're working very hard. We have real resources the Department of Defense have put against these language initiatives. My goal is that within 2 years, 60% of my command can speak one of the languages of the region, and we will get there. We also bring down people to come and talk who have written about the region or thinking about it. So there's a very rich basket of ideas that can be gathered out there. And in order to do effective strategic communications, you have to first understand the ideas, the cultural context. Next slide. Then you have to do things. You have to, as we say in the Navy, you have to cut some steel. You have to get down there and get at it. So we are doing things like sending a hospital ship down there. That's the Comfort. She did 400,000 patient encounters in 4 months. It follows up on an equally excellent voyage of the hospital ship Mercy, which went to Indonesia after the tsunami. Secretary Rumsfeld sent it there. Those are the kind of strategic communications efforts that pay enormous dividends in this part of the world. In the upper right is a large deck amphib. It's going to go down on a voyage next summer to follow up on the Comfort, because you can't do these things as a one-shot wonder. You have to have the follow-up. You have to be engaged. You have to be part of it. In the upper left there is a high-speed vessel. Represents the application of technology, bringing that to bear in these problems. That's a wonderful high-speed platform, very inexpensive. It's a converted car carrier. We use it in Southcom to move natural disaster supplies around. We use it to move training teams around. We use it to move repair capability into different difficult-to-get-into areas. It has a draft of only 8 feet and can carry 70 tons of cargo. So you have to apply technology, you have to do things in order to do this strategic communications. Next slide. Lest we forget, this is a combatant command. We remain fully capable of conducting combat operations. We interact with our opposite numbers, the other militaries in the region. This is the George Washington aircraft carrier, which is going to do a voyage around South America this summer. It's going to do a lot of partner exercises with Brazil and Argentina and Chile. It's going to dip into the Caribbean and do exercises there with Trinidad and Tobago and other countries. It's to demonstrate that there's real military capability in addition. This really gets into the whole smart power concept. It's not hard power or soft power. It's knowing when to use what. And we are fully capable of doing those kind of operations in stride with the other kinds of strategic communications we've talked about. Next slide. This part of the world, the blue helmets work. The blue helmets work. The United Nations has a mixed track record, let's be honest, in these kind of operations. What they are doing in Haiti is very successful. Today in Haiti, there are 7,000 UN peacekeepers, and they're doing a very good job of building a base of stability so that very troubled country can resurrect itself from decades of misery and poverty. And they're, as a result, keeping waves of Haitian migrants from coming to the United States. That's the United Nations, 7,000 peacekeepers. Today there are 4 U.S. personnel involved in that operation on staff. My point is this is a perfect example of using partner capability and capacity. The vast majority of the people in Haiti are from this region. They're from Brazil, which commands it. Brazilian general, excellent officer in command of it. They're from Chile. They're from Argentina. They're from Uruguay. Pop quiz, what country in the world has the highest per capita number of peacekeepers? Uruguay. Uruguay, a small country of 3 million in southern South America. So this peacekeeping is a real bonding mechanism between the militaries in the region. It's real capability. It's doing real tasks. And it's part of the landscape in this region that we need to understand in order to interact appropriately. Next slide. That should be a famous guy. Not many people know who he is. Maybe some of my Colombian friends would know who this is. This is Don Diego. The best analog I can give our U.S. friends in the audience is, if this were 1920, that guy would be Al Capone. He was the head of the largest drug syndicate, the North Valley Cartel, Valle del Norte Cartel, in Colombia. Before he was captured in September of last year, the FBI of the United States of America had a $5 million price on his head. He was the number 2 guy behind Osama bin Laden in terms of monetary return. Why is that? Because 7,000 people a year die of cocaine deaths in the United States. That's twice 9/11. That's every year. So this gentleman, that's really using the term loosely, was captured. I put that image up there not just because of the impact of stopping a major drug lord, and this was done by the Colombians. This is a Colombian success. I put it up there because another facet of this region is understanding how police forces and military forces can work together. That's a hard problem, right? I mean, if you look at the history of this region, the connection of human rights abuse by militaries in this region is profound. Argentina, Chile are both unfortunate examples of that, and many other countries in Central America throughout the region. As a group, all of us in militaries in the United States and throughout the region need to understand how to do the things militaries can do to support police forces, things like logistics, intelligence, transportation, but remain separate from the law enforcement function because merging those two has led to human rights problems. So I think the Colombians are facing this particular challenge well. They're working hard at it, and we are all in the region very cognizant of understanding how our military force and our police forces need to work intelligently together. Next slide. We've talked a lot about drugs. This is the absolute point of the spear for the Department of Defense. This is the Joint Interagency Task Force in Key West, Florida. It is, just like the name says, it's joint. It has all the services. It's interagency. It has excellent representation from all of the interagency actors. It's international. 20 flags of all the countries in the region fly in front of its headquarters. And their job is detection and monitoring in the transit zone. And they do a pretty good job. Last year, they stopped almost, over the last 2 years, they stopped almost 500 tons of cocaine from coming into the United States of America. 500 tons of cocaine. Just to put that in context, that's enough cocaine for every high school child in the United States, all 18 million of them, to have 150 hits of cocaine. That's three a week for a year. That's a year's package of cocaine stopped for every high school kid. So we're stopping a lot. The bad news is a lot's getting through. More is getting through than we are stopping. And there's a long discussion we could have specifically about narcotics and drugs and the effects here. Suffice it to say, I put this slide up because, in my opinion, this kind of joint, interagency, international work together is what this region's security's future is all about. And I think it's very important, and it's an excellent model. Next slide. So why does a DOD guy put up a slide with a really big State Department thing in the middle, and then USAID and Homeland Security and Justice and DNI, Director of National Intelligence? I put it up there because I can't do my job unless those folks want to work with me, are working with me, are embedded in my headquarters. I would argue that just like Joint Interagency Task Force in Key West is a small example of this kind of cooperation, the right model for our combatant commands moving forward, at least in my area of the world, is one that has a large State Department component. And I'm not talking hundreds of people, but I'm talking a dozen or so embedded. And you know, the Foreign Service is tiny. I mean, there's like 6,000 Foreign Service officers. That's the crew of one aircraft carrier. That's all the Foreign Service officers in the world. But I'd like to get a dozen or so at Southcom. I'd like to get half a dozen people from AID and Department of Homeland Security. And it's not because we're trying to take over at Southcom. It's because we want to be like a big Velcro cube that these other agencies can hook to so we can collectively do what needs to be done in this region where I believe the solution sets are, again, interagency, international. It's just fundamental to how we can do business in this part of the world. Next slide. And I would argue there's one step beyond joint and international and interagency. I mean, in the United States, we've all gotten very comfortable with joint, right? Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, Coast Guard, we all work together very well. The next step is really the interagency. And we're collectively, as a government, as a country, in our national security, we're edging toward real interagency cooperation. That's good. The next step is the private sector. I mean, that's the next thing. It's private-public cooperation. Let me give you an example. This, obviously, is an ambulance. It's being offloaded from a U.S. Navy ship in a small town in southern Argentina. And it's down there because of this hybrid operation that started off with a commercial side, a pure private sector entity, an ambulance company, that had a couple of ambulances that they wanted to donate to the world. In the middle is a hybrid, kind of a non-governmental organization called Project Handclasp, and they were in touch with the ambulance company, but they couldn't get the ambulance down there. So we had a ship that was going anyway to Argentina on an exercise we call UNITAS, so we put it on the back, took it down there, had great strategic communications value, did a lot of good in a small place in Argentina, and we were able to kind of connect those dots between private sector, a private-public hybrid, an NGO, and a purely public sector entity, U.S. Southern Command. That's the future of this kind of strategic communication, this kind of outreach. And Comfort, the hospital ship, is a macro example of that. That hospital ship had Navy people, but our Navy people are pretty involved doing Navy medicine over in the Gulf, where they should be. So we filled up the Comfort with volunteers from NGOs, public service, interagency, had a lot of people from all other walks of life. That kind of partnering, that public-private partnering, I think is kind of the next big thing. If joint And interagency were the first two things. This private-public is kind of the next big thing. We should think about how that applies. I'm almost done. This is an iceberg. You know that. You must say, why would an admiral put an iceberg? Navy admirals should hate icebergs. They sink ships. I'll tell you a quick story about language in this. I was given this presentation in Madrid because I was trying to convince the Spanish to be more involved in this region of the world. And I was giving it in my extremely crude but reasonably effective Spanish. And I got to this slide, and I didn't know the word for iceberg in Spanish. And so I said to the Spaniards who were sitting there, about a dozen around the table, ¿Cómo se dice en español? Yes, and, you know, how do you say this in Spanish? And they were kind of perplexed, and one of them said, ah, I know, es un iceberga. And the other Spaniards all said, no, that's Spanglish. And there is a word for this. It is temprano. Temprano is an iceberg in Spanish, according to the Spanish Royal Academy. So why is this picture here? This picture is here because an iceberg is a good image for what we're talking about. Just a little bit sticks above the surface of the sea. That little bit sticking up there, that tip of the iceberg, is what we do in the public sector. It's the combatant commander, it's a little bit of interagency, a little bit of international partnering, but the rest of the iceberg, the mass of the iceberg, is really in the interagency together, the international forces together, and the private public sector together. And so the question for us is, how do you bring the iceberg together? How do you create a way to bring that level of capability to this region, if you buy the argument that this is a home we share together and that these linkages matter and that this is an important part of the world? And I think you do it by international, interagency, private-public partnering. Next slide. I got three slides left, and they're easy. They're all three magazine covers. This is an excellent publication called The Americas Quarterly. It's put out by the Council of the Americas. And it has an article, it has a security lock with a dial you spin. And instead of numbers, it's military, politicians, citizens, business, police. And the point of it is, you have to bring it all together. It's that iceberg metaphor. If you're going to unlock this combination, you have to pull together. Next slide. This is one of everybody's favorite magazines, The Economist. Brains, not bullets, how to fight future wars. It's got a bandolero there. You think, yeah, perfect, war-fighting image. Look closely. Those aren't bullets. They're fountain pens. It's ideas. It's the power of ideas. It's strategic communications. It's brain-on-brain warfare. That's what we're all about here. And again, in this part of the world, the likelihood of launching a Tomahawk missile is low, but the need to launch ideas is powerful, pressing, and urgent. Next slide. Honestly, I use this not only when I'm briefing at CSIS. smart power, I believe. I think, you know, life is a rheostat. It's not an on and off switch. You know, soft power, hard power, that's an on and off switch. Smart power is a rheostat. And you dial that rheostat differently at different times, and you dial it differently in different parts of the world. And I hope what we've talked about tonight is how we think we should dial it in this part of the world. Last slide. That is a semi-submersible submarine. It's small. It's very small. It's two people fit inside it. It is a model of what the Colombian drug cartels are using today. This is the next wave of what they are doing. The Colombian cartels have built semi-submersible submarines that can carry more than 5 tons of cocaine. They can go at 15 knots for short sprints. They can be refueled at sea. They're made out of fiberglass. They have radars. They know what's in the water around them. That is profound innovation. Profound innovation. Why do I put that in front of my headquarters? It's not a trophy of war. We caught about 10 of these things. More are getting through. We caught 5 of them still being built. The Colombians caught 5 of them still being built in the jungle in Colombia. 5 of them in a little shipyard in the jungle being built. At one point, somebody in my command, this is a very small submarine, somebody in my command asked my CAG, "I see that submarine in front of the headquarters. Was that Admiral Stavridis' first command?" I said that to Admiral Mullen the other day in a briefing, the chairman, and he said, "Well, it might be your last command, Stavridis." No, it's not my first command. I put it there because every day 1,500 people drive by that thing to come to work at Southcom, and I want them to look at it and understand that the people we are competing with are smart. They're innovators. They wake up every morning thinking, how can I get more drugs into the United States? How can I undermine the Friends of the United States? How can I overthrow the Colombian government? How can I move the political meter in a way that is uncomfortable for the United States? We are up against smart, competitive innovators. And at the end of the day, I'm confident we will do very well in this region. I'm very optimistic. Why? Because our ideas are good. Not because we're a big, powerful country, not because we have great people. Those things are all true. But I think we will do very well in this region because we will think. We will be innovators. And I believe, in the end, my optimism about Latin America is predicated on the power and the promise of this region, but also on our ability in the United States to contribute in positive ways with innovation. So thank you very much. You've been wonderful.